If people are dieting now more than ever before, then why are nearly 1 in 3 American adults overweight? Dr. Gundry, who's helped thousands lose weight and feel younger and healthier than ever, says most people are not getting enough fat-burning MCTs from their food. MCTs are a special kind of compound that, instead of turning into fat when you consume it, turns into ketones, which is a chemical that breaks down the excess fat in your body. So, by getting more MCTs in your diet, you essentially flip a switch that puts your body in caloric bypass mode, which can flush out excess fat and calories. And he's created an easy way for you to activate caloric bypass right at home. It's called MCT Wellness. This powerful blend of fat-flushing MCT powders and antioxidant-rich polyphenols is designed to help you unlock your body's fat-burning, energy-producing potential. What's even better is that it's a delicious drink. I love how incredible it tastes. All you do is add a scoop to water, enjoy, and watch as you start feeling slimmer and more energized. So, if you want to experience a quick, easy, and effective way to melt pounds fast, go to GundryMD.com/energy and order right now to get up to 53% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. Again, that's GundryMD.com/energy.
How do people feel about getting Big Fitness Energy at Planet Fitness for $15 a month? They feel as thrilled as a kid the first summer they're tall enough to ride the roller coaster. That's right. When you join Planet Fitness right now, you get access to tons of equipment and free fitness training in a clean and spacious club. Don't wait. Join the judgment-free zone today for that all-day energy. Download the free Planet Fitness app and join today for $15 a month.
Hurry. Deal ends September 12th. Join today for $15 a month.
See Home Club for details.
This episode of Harvey Brownstone Interviews is brought to you by the Harvey Brownstone Talk Show Blend Coffee, available at HollywoodBlends.com. Everyone's saying it's the best coffee they've ever tasted. Why not give it a try and see for yourself?
Hello, everyone. I'm Harvey Brownstone, and today's guest is an iconic and beloved actor, singer, TV personality, producer, and director who is well remembered for his portrayal of Officer Vince Romano in the highly popular TV show T.J. Hooker. And of course, we all know and love him as the leader of the T-Birds, Johnny Nogarelli, in Grease 2, and as the hilarious Jay O'Neill in the hit movie Bachelor Party, co-starring Tom Hanks. But our guest has had a long and diverse career that goes well beyond those two memorable roles. On the screen, he appeared in The Final Terror, Eyewitness to Murder, The Other Woman, Unconditional Love, The Drone Virus, The Craving Heart, and many more great movies. And on TV, in addition to T.J. Hooker, he appeared in dozens of TV shows, including Starsky and Hutch, Good Time Girls, Hotel, Murder, She Wrote, Diagnosis Murder, Passions, Lady Dynamite, Larry the Cable Guy's Christmas Spectacular, and many more shows, in addition to hosting Dance Fever for 2 seasons. And on the stage, our guest has had a very special and unique connection with the legendary record-breaking musical Grease. He played Danny Zuko on Broadway and in national touring companies multiple times, and he also starred on Broadway in Falsettos and Blood Brothers and in the National Touring Company of Chicago. In 1992, he appeared off-Broadway in the musical version of Eating Raoul, and he has starred in many other theatrical productions, including Same Time Next Year, Little Shop of Horrors, Jesus Christ Superstar, Godspell, La Cage aux Folles, Children of Eden, The Ark, and Surf the Musical. Our guest is also a recording artist. His voice is featured on the soundtracks and cast albums for the movies and shows he's been in. And in 1984, he released his own self-titled solo album. And if all of that weren't enough, our guest also teaches master classes in film technique and gives musical theater workshops in Los Angeles and New York. I am delighted and honored to welcome the wonderful Adrian Zmed to our show. Adrian, thank you so much for being here.
Well, it's my pleasure. I can't stand to live up to that introduction of yours. I mean, who the hell is this guy? My God.
The best thing is that you already have.
Oh, yeah, right. Okay.
Well, I have to start by telling you that I've had the pleasure of interviewing several people who were closely connected to the show and the movie Grease. We've had Tom Moore, who directed the Broadway show. We've had the director of the movie, the first movie, Randall Kleiser, on the show. And we've also had Adrienne Barbeau, the original Rizzo on Broadway. And now we have you, Danny Zuko. And you've played the role more times than any other actor in history. So I have to tell you, this is quite a thrill for me.
Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate it. But yeah, it's true. Nobody's logged in more. I played Danny in 3 decades. if you add all of the Broadway and national tours that I've done, it's almost 11 years of performances.
I hear your nickname is Robo Zuko. Is that right?
That's what Jim Jacobs, the writer of Grease, one of the writers of Grease, Jim Jacobs, has given me that honor of being Robo Zuko, because I never miss a show.
I've had a lot of actors tell me, Adrian, that it's tremendously difficult to keep playing the same role year after year and to keep it fresh for the audience. But you've played Danny Zuko literally thousands of times. And you didn't have a lot of experience. You got the role right out of drama school. So how did you keep your performance so fresh for so many years?
That's a good question. Certainly in the beginning, yeah, I was quite green. My, you know, just flung onto right out of acting school into the national tour of the original Grease back in 1976 and all. But it was more of a learning process for me. So that's why it wasn't difficult to make it exciting every night, 8 shows a week and all. But in the other incarnations of it, I would say if you're going to do a show for 11 years, 8 shows a week, Grease is the show, because you can always change it up a little each night and keep everybody on stage on their toes. Not enough to throw things off, but just for it to be fun and to say, okay, this is not just by memorization, where he's throwing stuff at us that we haven't seen before and everything. And I had a tendency to do that, to keep everybody, you know, fresh with the show. But again, it's because we're playing high school kids. And high school kids is about having fun, you know, and that's what I tried to do with absolutely every show. I would kind of like spend my time off just figuring out what I could do to make everybody, you know. I did a lot of practical jokes. Let me put it that way, and which kept everybody on their toes all the time. And if you're going to do it in a show, it fits in to the high school antics that, you know, teenagers have. So it was a joy to do that show.
What was the biggest difference for you in working with Tommy Toon, who directed the 1994 revival, versus being in the show in the 70s?
Well, oh God, at that point, Grease was the original Grease was a parody of what the 50s was, which in the 70s. And that show was really never meant for children. That was meant for adults. I go so far back with Grease is that I almost did the original Grease in Chicago when they were on a little street called Lincoln Avenue, the Kingston Mines Theater, which was only 5 blocks from where I grew up. And I was in high school at the time when it was happening, and I auditioned for it and I got the role of Duty, but I was failing in math and my father wouldn't let me do it. So I never ended up doing the original, but I knew the show very well and wanted to do it badly. So to answer your question, that version was really meant for adults. It was very raunchy, very much for people who grew up in the 50s and are looking back at it in the 70s at that point. Now, when Tommy Toon revived it, along with Jeff Calhoun, Tommy Toon was actually the producer and overseer of the project and did direct, but it was actually Jeff Calhoun who directed and choreographed most of the show. and all that. At that point, in the 70s, it was a parody of the 50s. But in the 90s, it was a parody of a parody, because it was now a parody of the movie. And it became something different than what the original was. And even Tommy and Jeff kind of like were, they had their ideas on how to make it work. But one of the things that they were doing was working against the characters. When you get the script of Grease, in the very beginning, Jim Jacobs and Warren Casey, who wrote it, brilliantly just put the description of every character down at the very beginning of the script. If you cast that person who walks into your office and auditions for you, everything will fall into place. It's almost the perfect musical in a way. And it always works if you cast the people for who they are. Marty is the sexy girl who's dreaming like Marilyn Monroe all the time. Rizzo is the tough girl who's blah, blah, blah. Sandy is the good girl. Jan is it's just all of those, the pink ladies and the T-Birds fit in perfectly. And I call, because the original one was more of a black and white kind of a thing on stage with all of the, there was a montage of a backdrop of all of these sights from the 50s, people doing hula hoops, Elvis Presley, you know, pictures, and the James Dean and stuff. Whereas the one in the 90s, I called it the colorized version of Grease, because it was neon. Everything was neon all over the stage. So it was, again, it still was Grease, but it was just a different version of it. And the one of the things that I discovered after, I had done a couple of tours of it in the 80s too, and all I could see a change happening because people were more familiar with the movie and all. When I walked out on stage on Broadway, and I had just left Blood Brothers to go do it, I was ready to do my old Zuko, and suddenly I looked out into the audience and it was half children. And I had my sons backstage who were like 8 and 4. So I'm a parent. I'm not going to do some of the raunchy things that are called for in the script. And they were planning on doing all that stuff. I completely went to the version that Jim Jacobs and Warren Casey wrote that was for high schools, to do it in high school. So it was lyrics were changed on songs. You weren't giving anybody the finger or anything like that, or doing raunchy things. So I immediately changed my performance, and the producers said, "Where did you come up with this?" And I says, "Just Jim and Warren wrote a clean version. Just asked them to send it to you." And we kind of incorporated then the cleaner version at that point. But again, you know, Jeff and Tommy's version was much more loud and boisterous and colorful and all. It was more, it was softer. It was just a softer version of Grease, which is what people really like know and accept right now. If you were to see the original, you'd be putting your hands over your kids' eyes. with some of the things that were going on stage in the original, but equally fun in every version that I ever did. So it was a joy doing the original and joy doing the Tommy Toon version.
That's so amazing that the same show can be raunchy or very wholesome. And the producers didn't anticipate the audience in the 90s. They didn't realize the appeal that show had for kids. And good on you. Good on you to help them reinvent it.
And then they did the live version on NBC, you know, of Grease and stuff. And that was even a parody of a parody of a parody at that point, the way they did it. But it's still, in its essence, is Grease. It's one of the things that makes Grease work are the T-Birds and the Pink Ladies. Everybody can relate. One of the people ask me, why is Grease so successful? It's well written and has great songs. There's no question about it. But everybody went through high school. So everybody can relate to what those people on stage are going through. And everyone can relate to one of the characters, probably. And that's why there's so much appeal to Grease and why it works so much. It's like you can't help but smile and say, Oh yeah, I remember. I was like Eugene, the nerdy guy. Oh yeah, I remember. I was like Duty, the low man on the totem pole in the T-Birds, and stuff. And everybody can relate to something that happened in Greece and just smile about your time in high school. In fact, I think I had a better time doing high school in Greece than I did in my actual high school. So.
Oh, I have no doubt of that. Now, before we move on to your Hollywood career, Adrian, I have to mention that you did something that everyone on Broadway still talks about. You were given only 2 weeks to learn the score of Falsettos, which is a 36-song opera. How in the world did you manage to do that?
Damn, you've done your homework. Wow. It was probably the most intense 2 weeks of my life. That one was really something. How did I do it? I was supposed to do the national tour, and I knew that I was doing the national tour, but Michael Rupert, who was starring in Falsettos on Broadway, was physically had some problems. And the producers called me up and said, Adrian, we need you to go in 2 weeks and spell Michael before we put the national tour out. And I said, okay. And I proceeded to do everything I could to try to memorize 36 songs, no spoken word, all singing and all. And I literally put the whole show on what we had back in the day called cassette players with a tape. And I literally went to sleep with it looping all night and day, constantly listening to the song so that by osmosis, subconsciously, while I'm sleeping, I hear the songs and it somehow got into my brain. I don't know how I managed to pull it off. I have to admit, for the first couple of weeks, especially opening night and stuff, I had little cheat sheets all over the set, about certain spots where I was having trouble with and everything. But I did it. I made it. And it's let me tell you, Bill Finn wrote Falsettos, and it's really one of the most brilliant musicals ever written. Because it's written to be conversational, yet sung, and that in one line of measures and everything, he changes time constantly so that it sounds conversational, but you're actually singing it. So it's like he was doing rap before rap started. And all, although rap was happening then too, but it was, but we were singing. There was a melody to it, and everything. But we were, it was just, it's brilliantly written, absolutely brilliantly written. And it's one of the most, it's very difficult for young actors getting into musical theater to do that show. It requires an enormous amount of rehearsal because of how he wrote it. So yeah, thank you for actually noticing that. But it was one of the my great accomplishments. In musical theater. And it was
Oh,
a joy
for
doing.
sure. In my opinion, it is one of your greatest accomplishments as a performer. Adrian, can you remember the moment when you decided for sure that you were going to be a performer for the rest of your life?
Oh yeah. It was literally when I did my first high school play and the curtain went up and I did my first song and I said, oh, this is really nice. I'm good at this, and I think I can do this and be very happy doing this for a long time. Little did I know, as to much to the my father not wanting me to become an actor and do this, that it's probably one of the most difficult professions to conquer. I mean, think about it. There's maybe about even these days. I guess because of cable and so many programs and so many networks now and stuff like that. But back in the day when I was launching myself, there were only three networks. Not a lot of work for actors. Maybe, a 1,000 jobs to 2,000 jobs a year in Hollywood. Oh, if you include theater, then you're getting into the tens of thousands and stuff. But you're talking about, a million people who want that job. And when I teach acting, I say, you do realize that you're entering a profession that probably doesn't exist. So you have to really want to do this more than anything in the world. And if you persevere, I promise you that you will get somewhere in this business. And it I was, I can't believe how fortunate I was. I was blessed to immediately fall into doing Danny in Greece in the national tour of the original show. And I never stopped working from that moment on.
You mentioned your father. He was a Romanian Orthodox priest. You grew up
Yes.
in the church singing the Gregorian chants from the age of five,
Yeah.
and your dad wanted you to become a priest. So what did your parents think of your decision to pursue a career in show business?
Well, it's funny. My father, of course, was protesting all the time, and my mother secretly, they're from the old country, from Romania, born in Romania and everything, and they had a dream for their when they came to America for their kids to be doctors, lawyers, architects, whatever, and that's what my father wanted. But my mother always, even in Romania, as a teenage girl, was always getting the movie magazines and things like that, and looking at the stars from Hollywood. She always had a secret dream that one of her children would be an actor someday. Well, I didn't know that. I had no idea that she actually. I do remember, even in the United States when I was a kid, that she was always looking at movie magazines, always. But I never put it together that, it was her secret dream. So my mother always secretly said, just you be okay with it. He will come around. You will see. You will win him over. It's going to be good. And I did. It was a funny night. Not a funny night, but that finally won my dad over. It was that original production of Grease. We were on tour and we were coming into Chicago with the show. And we were playing one of the biggest theaters in Chicago, the Civic Opera House, which is a 5,000 seat place. And it's just ridiculous to bring Grease there. But that's all that was available for the producers. So the company manager came up to me and said, We can't fill this house, so we're going to paper it. Have your dad invite the entire congregation. And at that point, my father was billing one of the biggest Romanian congregations in the United States, and there were, 500, 600 people that came in, and they were all from my church, and I knew them as a child growing up. So every time I walked on stage, there was a huge chair. I didn't even have to do anything and stuff. And that night, my father, kind of came around and acted like he was proud of everything that I did and all. But the funny thing is that he just never quite understood what I did, especially when I he could see the effort that I made on stage in those 3 hours. But when I did my first series, T.J. Hooker, well, not my first, but that was the one that finally hit and everything. He'd watch the episode and he'd say to you, "You work for 1 hour. What do you do rest of week?" I said, "Well, it takes a long time to have that 1 hour that happen." And when I brought him out and he saw how what it was, he spent a day on the set with me. He said, "Waste of time." So he came around when he saw that I could make a living at what I was doing. He completely came around eventually.
You know what I love about that night in Chicago? It's not just that you won your dad over, it's that his community got to see you.
Yeah.
You know, that's your community, that's your heritage. I just love that, I have to tell you. Now, before you became Romano on TJ Hooker, I remember seeing you as a disco dancing pickpocket killer on Starsky and Hutch. What did you think of that role?
Well, it's a crazy what because it was such a complicated role that you thought he was the killer and then he was a pickpocket, but then he was a dancer and everything and all. It just happens to be that actually was my audition for T.J. Hooker because Aaron Spelling produced Starsky and Hutch, and he liked my work on that, and he pretty much had me in mind when they were creating the show for Bill Shatner to for me to be, in that show. So I had a string. I had just gotten come from New York, having done Danny the original on Broadway and the national tour and all. And when I arrived in Hollywood, I called myself the poor man's John Travolta. There weren't a lot of people who looked Italian that could dance at that time. And of course, Saturday Night Fever was an explosion like crazy. So when I landed in Hollywood, the networks all had their version of Saturday Night Fever. They did a pilot of what their interpretation of Saturday Night Fever was. Because back in the day, everything was a clone of something that was a hit. at that time. So I already started getting a reputation as one of the only people who could actually act and dance and do all of the stuff that John did. So it was a very unique role on Starsky and Hutch that I also needed to dance. And all. In fact, one of my manager's other clients was on that particular episode. Amanda McBroom played somebody that I supposedly was stalking and trying to kill and all. And Amanda is an amazing singer and songwriter. She wrote The Rose, for God's sake. So she's just remarkable. And to this day, it's just very fun that we always laugh about we met each other doing that show and spent a lot of time choreographing and doing, learning our stuff at my house with Amanda, to do the best that we could in that show. So really, Starsky and Hutch was my introduction to Aaron Spelling, who wanted me to do. It was the following pilot season, that they said, there's a show that Aaron Spelling wants you to come in for. I said, oh my God, okay. And all. So it was fun. It was,
you know what, though? I'm so fascinated that you mentioned John Travolta, because a couple of years ago when we had George Chakiris on our show, uh-huh. We got to talking after the interview, and I said to him, is there anybody that you think came along after you that was another George Chakiris? And right away he said, Adrian Smed could have done. Adrian Smed could have done West Side Story, the movie, like I did it.
I always wanted to do it, and it just passed me up in terms of my career, that when there was a revival, I wasn't right and ready for it. I was doing something else, and I could never time it so that I would do West Side Story. I've always wanted to do West Side Story. Unfortunately, I'm a little too old to be playing somebody that young now, even though I played Danny in 4 decades.
Yeah, you did your share. Now, yeah. One of the great things about T.J. Hooker that really stood out, as you know, was the on-screen chemistry between yourself and William Shatner, which is so interesting because you were a young, classically trained, very intense actor. He was such a relaxed guy. Were you intimidated by him at first?
Well, of course. You know, he was an icon even at that moment, in my life. At that time and all. And I have to say that he was my mentor. I honestly, just watching him do what he did made me realize that I don't have to try so hard. I don't have to work so hard. I wanted to cure cancer with my acting. It was just intense all the time. And then I'd see him do a monologue and a close-up and everything. And it was just... it was all right here. It was all in the eyes and everything. That's why the close-up works so well, because the eyes are the windows of the soul. And if you're not honest with what you're doing, people will just start, zoning out, with what you're doing. But if everything is going on in your brain and everything like that, they can see it's all happening in your eyes and truly in your body. You don't need the whole body, which is what I teach in my master classes, and say, you don't need your entire body when you're on camera. You just need, I say, on stage, you become the character. On camera, you have to be the character.
That's a subtle difference.
Yeah, you really have to be that person, which is why so many actors, when they're not filming, they're waiting for the lights to get set up or everything like that, still live into that, in that bubble, what they've just created, until they leave it at the off, on stage or on at the sound stage and go home and stuff. It's like you kind of like need to stay in that mode of who your character is, to concentrate and actually be true to it and be honest with what you're doing. I studied at the Goodman School of Drama in Chicago, and we did the I had a very valuable lesson doing children's theater at the Goodman School of Drama, because they always had a children's theater program on Saturday mornings. And I was, again, one of the only people in the acting school that could sing and dance. So I was always in the children's shows, because they were always musical based and stuff. And I learned in front of 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 year olds, you have to be just as honest as you are with adults with what you're doing. You cannot play at being something, or else they will start playing and talking and running around, and you lose their interest. But if you're honest to those 5 year old kids, they will stay glued to you as long as you're honest. There's a very valuable lesson in acting that you cannot be false.
You mentioned that Bill Shatner was your mentor. Did he ever give you any career advice?
Oh, yeah, he'd give me drops of wisdom, you know, here. Okay, you know, again, many of them was saying, Adrian, you don't have to work so hard. There's a term that directors use in Hollywood, less is more to actors. That's true, but a young actor does not understand that concept, less is more, because they start doing less, and then it's not as passionate and intense behind your eyes because they're just doing less. But you just have to understand the frame that you're acting in. But I, mostly by osmosis, learned a lot of what Bill did by learning, you know, from him. He actually just gave me a lot of life advice and everything. You know, he said, be careful with your money. You know, he was very concerned about that. You know, I know you're building a house in Studio City and this and that, you know, don't go overboard, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, to this day, I just saw Bill about a month ago, and we sat down and talked to, you know, had lunch and everything. And, you know, he just asked me, how are your finances and all. He's still concerned about, you know, that kind of thing. So I, you know, the funny thing about me and Bill is that we were so different in age. There was absolutely no competition whatsoever between the two of us. He was the man, and I was his partner, and I accepted that, and he knew that I accepted it, you know, and which is why our relationship worked so well. And we kept each other alive 13 hours a day by just playing practical jokes on each other to keep us loose.
Now, ABC canceled T.J. Hooker after 4 seasons, and before CBS picked up the show for the 5th season, you had already agreed to be the host of Dance Fever. Have you ever regretted not staying with T.J. Hooker?
Well, I wanted to, but I did. I had already accepted the job. But Merv Griffin heard that I was available and wanted to me to take the over on Dance Fever, and we were canceled. That's all I knew, and he called my manager and said, I'd love for Adrian to do this. And I said, wow, when do I get a chance to sing and dance in Hollywood? I had already done Grease 2. That's the only other time I had sung in Hollywood. So I did it. But it was really only like a week or so after I had accepted the whole thing that we found out that it was actually 4.5 years that I did it. When we did the first season of T.J. Hooker, we shot 8 episodes in our first year because we were a mid-season replacement. The way it turned out. So Aaron and Leonard Goldberg, the other producer of Hooker, the syndication package is 5 years of shows to sell something at that time in syndication, which means you can air an episode of whatever show you're doing 5 days a week the entire year without seeing another episode. That's what the 5 years of 26 shows a year. Nowadays, you're lucky if you do 8 shows a season or 9 or 10 shows a season. So it was really, it just, they needed that extra 10 to 15 shows that they did in nighttime. And it was nighttime. It was a late night, 11 o'clock or 11:30, 1 hour version of it, which really was weird. Because they never did anything that was an original drama at 11:30 opposite Johnny Carson or, you know, well, whatever the late talk show was. So it was really like those, I think it was like 12 episodes, 11 or 12 episodes that I didn't do that they did in late night. It killed me, honestly, because it was my family for 4.5 years, everybody. And I couldn't do both because the schedules just would not work out.
That was a real disappointment. You know, although, I mean, we all love Dance Fever, but it was a disappointment. Now, let me ask you about Grease 2. Of course, everyone knows You are, if not the only, you're one of the very few cast members who were actually in the Broadway show. But what really gets me, when I did my research, I learned that Pat Birch, who was the director, really wanted you to play Johnny, but you went through quite an ordeal to get the part.
Yeah.
You had 10 callbacks. Why did they put you through all that?
Well, here I'll explain to you why. But again, wow, you've done your homework, Harvey. She needed help with bringing the original Grease to the screen, she knows that Grease One really became a vehicle for John and Olivia, and that's fantastic, and that's wonderful, and obviously it's one of the most popular movies of all time, and well deserved. And Randall Kleiser did a phenomenal job, you know, with that show. But it wasn't what was on Broadway. It wasn't the original Grease. The original Grease was about all of the T-Birds and the Pink Ladies. And everybody had their moment in the stage version of Grease. And she needed help because it was her first big directing job on film. I knew she needed some help with me, you know, handling the T-Birds and trickling over into the Pink Ladies. And Maxwell was already cast, and so was Maxwell Caulfield and Michelle Pfeiffer were already cast. And at that point, they were not big stars at that moment. In fact, I think Michelle only had done the movie Hollywood Nights with Tony Danza at that point. And the producers, Alan Carr and Robert Stigwood, wanted a rock star in my role because they felt that they needed a name, since the only people who had done the first movie were the teachers in it, which was really kind of a clever idea, the way they did Grease 2 and all. But Pat just kept on pushing it and pushing it. Every time they brought in a rock star, she put me in right after they went, right after they walked out, I'd walk in and re-audition. And Alan and Robert said, all right, he's still contending for it. He's still contending for it. So, and that was about 10 times that I went through that ordeal until we started mixing and matching with the T-Birds and Pink Ladies at one large casting call that we had. But that was really kind of like she orchestrated it and managed to, you know, help me win it. And in fact, I am so, so honored and happy that I was able to do this. About a month and a half ago, I flew to New York, and Pat was honored by the Theater League for a Lifetime Achievement Award, and basically choreographing and directing 36 Broadway musicals. And, you know, Pat is in her 90s now and all. And it was just, I'm so happy that I was able to be there and experience that honor for her, because she deserves it. She's amazing.
So the real question, Adrian, for me, when I think of your performance as Johnny in Grease 2, how much of your Danny Zuko did you put into Johnny?
Oh, a lot. I had a very vulnerable, I acted tough. See, the key to Grease working is that we are not cool. We are trying to be cool. So you got to give that essence of trying, not actually our cool. If we were cool, we'd be the Flaming Dukes, the other guys on the motorcycles and everything like that. They were menacing and terrifying and everything like that. The T-Birds were not menacing and terrifying, because you can't really like people who are going to be that tough with things. So I brought quite a vulnerable quality to my Danny Zuko. So a lot of what I did was my Danny. It was all different words and songs and stuff like that, but the essence of my Danny was pretty much Johnny.
I want to take you back to June of 1982 at the premiere of Grease 2 in Chicago at the Biograph Theater, which was in your...
God, where did you get this stuff? What do you got? What do you have, like flies on walls? I mean, my God, yeah.
Okay. I do my homework.
One of the great moments of my life.
I do my homework, baby. Yeah, well, I want to take you to that moment. You're at the Biograph Theater. It was in your childhood neighborhood, What was it like sitting there in the audience with your parents, seeing yourself up there on that big screen?
It was, it was one of those moments that you thank God that you actually are experiencing what I've experienced. I, as you said, this old theater, the Biograph Theater, which is the theater where John Dillinger was shot by the FBI. It's a famous landmark in Chicago. And I used to go there to see triple features on Saturday mornings and all. And when Alan Carr asked me, what theater would you like us to have to do the Chicago premiere of Grease 2 in? And I said, could you possibly do it at the Biograph, the theater that I used to go to as a child? And he said, okay, let me see, look into it. And you made it happen. And of course, it was unbelievable to be sitting next to my parents during the premiere of my movie at a theater that my father brought us to see the King of Kings, the big, religious, motion picture, King of Kings and stuff like that. And everybody in the church was there and stuff like that. And now, literally a half mile from where my father's church is the theater that I'm now starring in, on a big screen. It was surreal. It was surreal. And just one of those moments of, wow, thank you. I must be doing something right.
Well, you did. And it, for your fans, it makes us feel very gratified that you got to share that moment with your parents and go back to your roots. Grease 2 has become, as you know, enormously popular as a cult movie. You mentioned that the essence and feeling of the original Broadway show was really captured more in that movie than in the original Grease. And I want to suggest to you, Adrian, I think Grease 2 was actually much more kid-friendly than the original Grease.
Absolutely. It was. Yeah. Yeah. I, to this day, and this is the reason I think, is because it's more kid-friendly, to this day, Grease 2 outsells and outrents Grease 1. If people rent anymore or download it or whatever. But once a lot of parents remember seeing it, so they introduce it to their kids. The phenomenon of the video generation is just unbelievable. For me, at my age, to have five-year-old kids dressed as Johnny and doing, Score Tonight, for me, their little rendition, and that parents send me videos of their kids doing it and stuff like that. It's really amazing, to have that outpouring of love is what it is. And I feel like it's an incredible phenomenon is what it is. But you're right. It is a lot more kid friendly. I think that's one of the things as to why more parents will let their kids watch Grease 2. I mean, think about it. Grease 1. Sandy pretty much changes her whole life to become a slut for her boyfriend. And Rizzo, we think, is pregnant the entire, movie, for crying out loud. So it's that some of the themes in the original were supposed to be looked at by adults, not kids. But it's still a very important part of even the movie.
So you mentioned Score Tonight. Can you still hit that super high note?
If I work and open that part of my vocal range, it's, it's so funny. I just did, just before the pandemic, I did a year and a half of La Cage aux Folles in the United Kingdom. And the range for the character of George is lower than my range. And I had a tough time in the beginning, but after about a month or two, my voice was trained to go to that lower register and everything. And I had a great baritone bass, with my voice during La Cage, but I can completely open up all of that high falsetto stuff if I start doing something else and exercising. The vocal cords are a muscle, really, when you come down to it. It's just a muscle, and you just have to train that part of the muscle to be working again. But no, I can look. the 50 stuff is just so part of me. It's like, I get up in the morning, my hair looks like this. It just goes into that pompadoury kind of like 50s kind of look. So it just takes me to singing the song several times, and it all comes back.
My favorite song from Grease 2 is Prowling. And you mentioned Score Tonight. Do you have a favorite song from the movie?
Well, it is Prowling. I love Score Tonight. Because it was really, truly a lot of fun, you know, for us to do it. And it took almost a month to shoot that whole bowling alley sequence. But Prowling is special to me because of how it ended up getting into the movie. Pat took me aside, and we were very late going over schedule and shooting. And one of the last things that we were going to be shooting was Prowling. And Pat said, we're running out of time. And I don't think we can spend the time to shoot the entire song. We can only shoot the end of it at the talent show. And the way, you know, you do things in musical movies is that you record it and then you lip sync it to, you know, and then so we had to record it like a week or two, but before, when Pat heard it, she brought it to the producers and she brought it to the production team to say, how can we do this? They basically said, we have to have this in the movie and we got to figure out a way. And because of Pat, we were able to shoot Prowling in a 24-hour period, which is unheard of, to shoot an entire song in a 24-hour period. She knew we were shooting one of the acting sequences at the gas station in the evening on location. And she said, we're going to start it here, and then we're going to finish it as if you're rehearsing in the auditorium. So we're going to do the first verse at the gas station, and then the rest of the song will be done. So we shot it. And then, boom, got into all of the whole company moved to the back to the high school, and we did the second half of it. You know, we with just a few hours of sleep the next day, and it was truly a team effort. Completely, it was Pat who figured out how to do it, along with the director of photography, and then me, the T-Birds, and I had to choreograph it and put it all together, and we pretty much put this whole thing together. It was a very exciting 24 hours. It was almost like doing live theater.
Well, knowing that gives you a whole new appreciation for the number. Now, yeah. Adrian, as you know, everybody loves Bachelor Party. And it looked to me like you and Tom Hanks were having so much fun on that set. But how much of what we saw on screen was ad-libbed or improvised?
A lot. Quite a lot. Sometimes we just looked at what we had to do and say, and we just took off with things constantly.
Well, was there a moment during the filming of that movie where you and Tom figured this has got to be the end of our careers?
Yes. We would carpool to work because we would get into the HOV lane, because we lived in Studio City, and the soundstage was in Culver City, so we had to go over the 405, which is a parking lot, even at 6 o'clock in the morning when you have to get to the set early and everything. So we said, "What are you going to do after this? Our careers are over." And unfortunately, Tom did okay after Bachelor Party.
So you were shocked when the movie became a big hit? You were really shocked?
I think we saw the first cut of it, and we looked at each other and said, "What happened? It actually is funny. It's good. It works." And to this day, again, it's like a cult classic. You know, it's kind of a timeless movie in a way. But, and I think it's because we really did have fun. Well, pretty much what we brought in front of the camera was what we were doing off camera. We just had fun and goofed off a lot and brought it to the front of the camera. And fortunately, our director and writers, Neil Israel and Pat Proft, they went with us. They let us do anything. You know, we came up with a suggestion, and Pat would come up, "All right, well, we'll turn around and then say, you know, okay, ladies, line up now." It all worked out like because everybody was on the same page with what we were doing. Their egos weren't big enough to keep exactly the same lines and everything, because they saw that we were having fun and we were making stuff even funnier than it was.
You know, one of my favorite performances of yours was in 1984. You played the husband of Teresa Saldana in a movie called Victims for Victims, the Teresa Saldana story. You were acting with the real Teresa Saldana. What was that experience like, Adrian?
Unlike anything that I've ever experienced in as an actor, to go to educate the inform the your audience a little. Teresa was an actress who was in the movie Raging Bull, and she played Joe Pesci's wife in Raging Bull, and she suddenly had a fan who basically stalked her and decided that his mission was to kill her. And he stabbed her 14 times just outside of her apartment building in Hollywood, and she survived. And as a result, in her recovery, she saw that the people who commit the crimes have more rights in the judicial system than the victims. So she started an organization called Victims for Victims, to be champions for people who have been wronged, and help them with the lawyer fees and get them fair trials and all. And so this was obviously a very important movie to Teresa Saldana. It was her life story and what she had started. And then to shoot pretty much in every location that everything happened to her was just beyond belief. I remember I said earlier in on stage you have to become the character, but on film you have to be the character. It took us about a month and a half to shoot that show, and I basically just lived like a hermit in my motorhome the entire time, to be in this dark cloud that was over her life at that time, to portray her husband, because she would arrive on the set and she was there. She was just like trembling immediately, you know, with things. She wasn't acting. She was living it again, is what it was. And in an interesting way, a lot of therapy for the people who went to Victims for Victims to get help for them is about facing those fears, about actually talking about it, about trying to relive some of those things. Because if you face it, then you realize that you're going to survive it again.
You know what I thought when I saw that movie? I thought about you, because you were an amazingly successful and highly popular star. You were, whether you want to believe it or not, a huge, huge sex symbol and a teen idol. Did it worry you, that part of being famous?
I Harvey, I tried, I fought. My manager wanted me to do a poster, you know, with a wearing a towel, you know, doing all the beefcake shots and things like that, going to the teeny bar. I just wanted to be an actor. That's all I wanted to do. And this was my first step into doing something more serious, something that pulls me away from the teeny bopper magazines and stuff. So no, this was something I really, really, really wanted to do, and I wanted to learn from it as an actor, and I did. I learned so much about myself, about you know, and you know, every actor who's worth anything has got to bring some of himself or herself to the role. And the only way to do that, honestly, is to tap into your own life about dark things that have happened to you and all. And that's what I lived for that time. So it really didn't care to me what it did to the other part of my career. I wanted to do it because it was a great role, and it was extremely challenging.
I'm going to mention another great role. In 1987, you starred in a classic episode of Alfred Hitchcock Presents called When This Man Dies. You play a mechanic.
Shot it in Toronto.
Yeah. Shot in Toronto. For the benefit of our viewers, Adrian plays a mechanic who owes a lot of money to a bookie who tells him he can have the debt paid off if he kills someone. That was a very intense, dramatic performance.
Yeah. One of those things where I said, oh yeah, this I can sink my teeth into. It was really kind of a scary, I mean, all of those, it was a remake of the original Alfred Hitchcock episodes and stuff. And what happens is that I had a debt to pay, and then I get a letter saying, when this man dies, you'll receive blah, blah, blah amount of money. I go, what the hell does this mean? all of a sudden I hear that this man was killed on the radio, and I suddenly open up an envelope with a bunch of money in it. I go, what is this all about? Then I get another envelope. When this man dies, you will, you know, get this much money. Now, as the letters came and the people died, I started getting anxious about how, when is this going to happen? And I would just get further and further into debt because I would gamble more and more money because I had more money to deal with. And I just got in deeper and deeper until eventually I killed the guy. And the next letter is, welcome to your new job, that I'm an assassin. It's a pretty cool episode. Really cool.
Yeah, it was a great episode. I'm glad I got to mention it. And I have to confess to you, one of the reasons I very much wanted to have you on our show is that back in 2009, I took a cruise on the Princess Cruise Lines, and you were the headliner, Adrian Zmed in concert. And you gave a fabulous show. What was it
like? Did I ever meet you?
Yeah, I met you. Not that you'd ever remember, but you were very gracious. And I said to you, you know, one day I'm going to, when I finish being a judge, one day I'm going to have a talk show and I'm going to interview you. And you said, oh, that's nice. What was it like living on a ship for all those months?
Oh, God, Harvey. There's something. I actually wrote a pilot, and somebody else has taken the name of what I wanted it to be. But it was my life below deck. And it's unlike anything I've ever experienced in my life, living on a cruise ship. Almost 5 years I did that. I really didn't know what I was getting into when I signed the contract. And all, but they made it very, very comfortable for me. They brought my wife out every month and my sons and everything. But it was one of those situations where, because it was a production show, I had two casts on two separate ships, and I had my costumes and everything. And I had two separate cabins with my own set of personal clothes and stuff. But it was me who left the ship. Like in Costa Rica, I'd get off the ship on the Pacific side, go through Costa Rica to San Jose, fly from San Jose to Miami, and then Miami to Aruba, and get the next ship who has my show the next day on it. So that was a grueling experience, to flying every week. It was almost a 20-hour travel day and stuff. But honestly, I wouldn't change it for the world. I had a blast.
Got to meet the fans. You really got to meet the fans.
I lived with them. I mean, you know, I we probably ran into each other in the restaurants on the cruise ship, or the bars, and, you know, and things like that. No, it was fun. It was fun, and still very dear friends, all of those people who I did the show with.
Now, in 2009, you were in a very unusual reality series called Confessions of a Teen Idol, co-starring Scott Baio, Jeremy Jackson, Christopher Atkins, and David Shokachi. You were basically being asked to bare your soul to the public in a group therapy session. So I just have to ask you, Adrian, because I feel like you're my friend. Looking back, do you think that was a good show for you to do?
You know why I did it? Well, number one, Scott Baio asked as a favor to me, as a favor to him, to do the show. And I really didn't want to do reality shows, but I said, you know what? If you don't like them, at least try it to see what they're like. Let's just see what it's like. And after doing it, I never will do any one of those ever again, because it's all about, it was sleep deprivation, and they wanted conflict, you know, to go on. So they pushed us to the point of not sleeping and putting us in positions to where we got angry and upset and stuff. So it was tough.
It was contrived.
Tough. Yeah. Yeah. They tried to create drama is what it was. And we didn't particularly like it. Some of them thrived in that reality show, you know, format, and they went with it and stuff like that. I sat in the background a lot and just shook my head and did things, you know, it's like, all right, I'll go along with it and all, but it's really funny that you should mention it. Jason Hervey from Wonder Years directed that that series. And Jason directed a lot of stuff that that Scott did. And I literally just saw Jason 2 weeks ago. And Jason kind of was under the impression of that I hated him for the Confessions of a Teen Idol. I said, of course not, Jason. You know, we figured it all out in the end, how to get it done the way you wanted it done and all. But it was a very interesting educational experience. I will never do one again. I'll do a competition show, like, you know, when I used to do Battle of the Network Stars, and, you know, or a game show or something like that. But a show when you're locked in a house for an entire month with everybody else, that's a different story. I won't do that again.
Well, you know what got me? It's that I always felt, as one of your fans, that you tried very hard not to be a teen idol. You really wanted to be taken seriously as an actor. Yeah. You knew you were sexy. You knew you had a following of young girls and gay guys and all of that. But you worked really, really hard to be taken seriously as an actor. So I didn't like the title, the Teen Idol. But it does seem to me, when I watched you on that reality show, that one of the lessons you conveyed, whether you know it or not, is that if you do become a sex symbol, don't believe your own publicity. Don't take yourself so seriously. That was the message that I think you gave us.
Well, I got that message from one of the greatest managers in Hollywood history. My managers, Bob Lamond and Lamond Zetter. Bob, those were the wisest words that he ever told me. He said, Adrian, I'm going to say incredible things about you, amazing things. I'm going to have you do things, and we're going to publicize it as amazing and remarkable and this and that. But do not believe the publicity and the things that I'm saying about you. Just stay honest with yourself and who you are, and be true to yourself, and don't ever believe that you're greater than who you are as a human being. And they were the wisest words that I've lived by my entire life, that they were ever given to me. And Bob and Lois, they handled almost every actor who played Danny Zuko in the original Grease on Broadway, from Barry Bostwick to Jeff Conaway to Richard Gere to Treat Williams to just, the list is endless of all of the guys who played Danny Zuko in the original. So their specialty was grabbing guys like me and creating careers, you know, in Hollywood for them. So I was very lucky to have a very wise managers who understood what they were doing and tried to keep all of their clients down to earth.
Well, in our remaining moments, I want to shine a light on something else that a lot of people may not know about you. You've been involved as a producer in two very important TV documentaries, Women Erased and Children Erased, which is about the very real and tragic crisis of missing and murdered Indigenous women and children in America. Mm-hmm. I want to commend you. I don't know how much you know about me, but I'm a retired criminal and family court judge who dealt with the Indigenous community for 40 years in a courtroom, 26 of them as a judge. I am so impressed and grateful that you saw the value in telling this story and being a voice for this marginalized community and on behalf of these women and children who no one knows what happened to them.
Right. Yeah. A lot of people don't know what's going on reservations. Being a sovereign state, they still don't own the land. The government still owns the land. So they allow for people, for companies, corporations to go on and drill on these reservations. And they call them man camps when they, you know, the government allows them to go there. And coincidentally, young women, Native American women, start disappearing when these man camps, you know, start happening. And there is a correlation, you know, to it all. And the general public has no idea what's going on. And here, as being a part of the judicial system, you probably know that unless there is actual proof that somebody committed a murder, the the law enforcement, it can only be the Native American law enforcement that handles it. But if you can prove that somebody was involved in this murder, that's when the FBI is brought in to help the situation. So most of the Native American law enforcement teams on the reservations, there's only four or five officers that are in charge of 10, 20,000 acres of land. They cannot be everywhere all of the time. And stuff. So I don't want to mention this to give anybody any ideas, but it's a perfect storm for somebody who's a serial killer, because you'll get away with murder in this situation because nobody does the investigating. Nobody can uncover what happened and when it happened and stuff like that. So to make a long story short, I don't know why. I feel in another life, I was a Native American. I've always, since I was in high school, been fascinated by the Indian, the Native American culture and the way of thinking and all. And I've always had something for it. And then when I started finding out about what was happening with MMIW, Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women, I said, why hasn't anybody done a show about helping people like what John Walsh did for missing children? Which, and I have a great friend of John Walsh, and he was quite helpful in many of the things that I have been doing with MMIW and all. Why hasn't anybody done anything like this? So we're still actively trying to get this show off the ground. We have one episode, one particular young lady who was murdered that was found, that we're doing a three to four part documentary on it, and that's how we're starting the series. And then, and we're calling it Women Erased, and then the offshoot of it will be Children Erased, because now we're uncovering what happened with all of the boarding schools across Canada and the United States, and that's a whole another different problem that we have to tackle. It's just that the public should know about these kind of things, and we have to do something to have these people have some closure with it. But the problem is that this has been going on for not just 40 or 50 years. It's been going on since the land was taken away from the Native Americans.
Well, I'm glad I get this chance to publicly commend you for what you're doing. Well, Adrian, I want to repeat something to you that your father used to tell you. He said that success is 10% inspiration and 90% perspiration. But almost every star who's appeared on my show has said that their success was about 50% good luck. So do you think your dad was right when it comes to show business?
Yes. And partially, it's when you do the formula that he said, 90% perspiration, 10% success, inspiration. It's when that whatever that is meets luck. You have to be in the right place at the right time to meet the opportunity, and then take that opportunity with your 90% perspiration to create that luck. And I believe that the energy that you put into it attracts that luck. And from what I see in so many cases of not just myself, but so many other actors, it's about the actor and actress being in the right place at the right time and their talent meeting what is required of that role. So it's kind of like both, but I feel that kind of like attracts the luck.
So. Adrian, it has been such a pleasure meeting you and having this chance to celebrate your amazing life and career. I want to thank you for all the entertainment you've brought us over these many years, all the education you've given to the younger generation of actors and performers. Thank you so much for taking the time to appear on our show.
Well, Harvey, and thank you too, because honestly, I'm kind of amazed as to the homework that you did on so many of the things in my life. You are quite remarkable yourself in what you do. So thank you for having me on the show, and it was my pleasure.
That means the world to me. Our guest has been the one and only Adrian Zmed. You can follow Adrian on social media by going to his official Facebook page, the official Adrian Zmed fan page. You can follow him on X, formerly known as Twitter, by going to Real Adrian Zmed. My name is Harvey Brownstone. Thank you all for joining us. See you next time.
Have a good day, everybody.
Thank you to my producer, Steve Silver, my managers, Rick Marcelli and Robin Bragg Marcelli at the Marcelli Company in Hollywood, my director of programming, Robert Monaghan, my PR directors, Eileen Shapiro and Jimmy Starr, and my entire team at the XPTV One Network in the UK.
Thanks for watching. Be sure to check out all the great interviews on the Harvey Brownstone Interviews YouTube channel. Don't forget to subscribe and ring the bell to be notified when new videos are posted.
How do people feel about getting Big Fitness Energy at Planet Fitness for $15 a month? They feel as thrilled as a kid the first summer they're tall enough to ride the roller coaster. That's right. When you join Planet Fitness right now, you get access to tons of equipment and free fitness training in a clean and spacious club. Don't wait. Join the judgment-free zone today for that all-day energy. Download the free Planet Fitness app and join today for $15 a month.
Hurry. Deal ends September 12th. Join today for $15 a month.
See Home Club for details.